Hello, and welcome to Learning for Life at Gustavus, the podcast about people teaching and learning at Gustavus Adolphus College, and the myriad ways that Gustavus liberal arts education provides a lasting foundation for lives of fulfillment and purpose. I'm your host, Greg Castor, faculty member in the Department of History. With spring in the Minnesota air, at least aspirationally, and the spring 2022 theater production at Gustavus not too far off, I thought now would be a good time to speak with two of the people intimately and intensively involved with that work, my faculty colleagues Matthew Reitmeier and Kimberly Braun of the Theater and Dance Department. The production in question is Gloria, a Pulitzer Prize finalist by playwright Brandon Jacobs Jenkins, for which Professor Reitmeier is assisting with the set and lighting, and Professor Braun is the director. Matt earned his Comprehensive Bachelor of Arts, or CBA, in Theater Arts from the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire and his MFA from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He's been teaching at Gustavus since 2019. Kim graduated from Gustavus, class of 2011, with a major in theater with honors, and earned her MFA from the University of South Carolina. She's been teaching at her alma mater since last fall, 2021. Each has extensive experience in the theater on the design and tech side in Matt's case, and the acting and directing side in Kim's. Matt's work includes productions of Hair, Camelot, West Side Story, and Evil Dead musical, while Kim, a proud member of Actors Equity Association, has performed various roles in New York, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., and elsewhere, and last year directed Kate Hamill's Sense and Sensibility, Molière's Misanthrope, and, to quote her, a new devised piece entitled Solstan, about which we'll talk later. Together, they make for quite an impressive creative collaboration, and I'm grateful they could join me to talk about their backgrounds, paths to the theater, professional work, and the upcoming campus production of Gloria. Plus, as a theater lover, I always enjoy learning about people on and behind the stage. So, Professors Reitmeier and Braun, Matt and Kim, welcome to this venue, dare I say this stage. It's great to have you on.
Thank you, Greg, for having us.
My pleasure. Good morning. So where are you guys? Are you in your offices?
I'm holed up in my living room where it's quiet for the moment.
Okay. And what about you, Kim? I too am at home in St. Peter.
Okay, you're both in St. Peter. And I'm in Minneapolis, the wonders of high tech. I always say at least it's not 1918. Thanks so much for taking the time. I was right before we started recording talking to Matt about how busy you are. I just know from sometimes hearing from students and colleagues like you just how intense the work is. But before we get to the spring play, Gloria, let's talk a little bit about you. And Kim, you could start. Tell us a little bit about your background, where you grew up, and how you became interested in the theater.
Sure. I grew up in Mankato, and I was involved in theater growing up at MSU and at the community theater in town. I had sisters who were involved, and I went with them to some auditions, and it never really occurred to me that that was a path you could pursue professionally until I was at Gustavus, and I was in a J-term production of A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, directed by my colleague now, Henry McCarthy, and choreographed by Michelle Rusinko, another colleague and chair of the department now, and it was so much fun to rehearse all day, and I thought, if this is what being an actor is, that's what I want to do. So I ended up pursuing.
Wow. So
here. Yeah, go ahead.
Did you have directing experience already through Gustavus or not?
I took directing as a class, but I didn't start directing until quite recently, until after I had my MFA. And I started developing some more specific opinions on acting.
Okay, we can get into that. What else? What else were you up to at Gustavus? I read you were also a singer.
That's correct. And I worked on Big Hill Farm.
Were you in
I was in the Gustavus Choir and the Chapel Singers before that. And I did the Chamber Singers as well, which is the 16-person, typically jazz ensemble and quartets. And, you know, I was just typical Gusty. I was in a lot of student organizations. We restarted the Sauna Society, and I worked in the Student Senate and Farm. And I got to go to India with the Social Justice, Peace, and Development program in its day.
So yeah. You had a really rich experience.
I had a wonderfully rich experience.
Yeah, yes. That's really cool. I'm envious. Well, the Big Hill Farm is awesome. Tell us just briefly about the Big Hill Farm. That's cool.
Well, it was started, of course, I didn't research this, brush up on this, but it was the year before I worked on it. So it would have been started in 2009, maybe. And it started as a way to sort of a laboratory for students to grow food. And then that food is still in use in the CAF for our award-winning cafeteria at Gustavus. And I have students right now in my acting class.
I think that's really cool.
Who work on the farm. And so I'm hoping we can line up a day to go as a class and work on our monologues while helping sow vegetables and turn the soil, because that's sort of a dream of mine, is to combine gardening with theater.
That's neat. I'm just kind of, my head is spinning at the thought of vegetables either applauding or rejecting the performances, but whatever, as long as it helps the vegetables to grow. That's cool. Very cool. We'll come back to your acting. Matt, what about you? Where'd you grow up and how did you get into the theater?
I grew up in north central Wisconsin, in a tiny little town called Medford. And I always had an affinity for the storytelling and the characterization, kind of being something you're not. Usually manifests itself in being animals and other type of creatures, yeah. Star Trek, Star Wars type creatures and that sort of thing. Because it was just fun to play as a kid, but also play and do the storytelling bit. And it wasn't until high school that I realized that the technology and design part of theater existed as its own entity. And we were, I don't remember what show, but I remember being at rehearsal after school one day in our high school auditorium and sitting out in the house waiting for rehearsal to start or whatever. And our technician, our AV tech, because, every school's got an AV tech. He was also our lights and sound and everything else tech guy. And he was on a ladder, and the ladder was propped up against the front of house beam out over the seats. And he was hanging and focusing a light. And I said, "Rich, what are you doing?" He goes, "Well, I'm focusing this light on this one spot for a scene." And he said, "Oh, that's a thing." And he said, "Yeah." He was a little gruff. He was friendly enough, but was very businesslike. So he was doing his thing, and then away he went. And then later, I realized that there's this whole computer program based control console that controls all the lighting, and right next to that is the soundboard, which I think more people are familiar with a soundboard and band setups than lighting.
Right.
And realized there's this whole other world. And I said, "Rich, what did you do before this?" And he goes, "Oh, I was a technician at the Grand Theater in Wausau." And I said, "Well, what did you do there?" And he told me about all of the things that he did there. And it kind of opened up that idea that there was this whole other track in the theater world. And then my senior year of high school, we did Little Shop of Horrors. And our director had a friend who was a scenic designer. And she designed the set for us and sent a model in the mail. And so in class or in rehearsal, he opened up the box and showed us the model. And I went, "Whoa, that's a thing." So every step along the way, it was just another layer of, "Oh, that's a real thing. People really do that. That's an actual career that you can do." And by the time I was out of high school, as interesting as performing was, I wanted to be a scenic designer. So I ended up getting into the tech and design classes at UW Eau Claire. And it's all history from there. But I ended up finding that I had a knack for building stuff and problem solving. So it led me through the technical director track more than it did scenic design. So although I've done both, my official title is technical director.
Well, I've seen on your I looked at both your web pages, which are awesome, both of them. But Matt, the photos, this is when I wish I could instantly have listeners see them, and I'll just direct listeners to Kim's webpage and Matt's. Just Google them and you'll find their pages. Really cool photos of what you've done, Matt. And what I like about what I'm hearing both of you speak, and this is kind of a theme of the podcast, is how people discover that, oh, I really like doing this. And you mean I can do it and get paid for it, do it professionally. It's a thing that exists. You know, that's part of, I think, the discovery that comes with, well, it comes with learning, whether in college or not, but very, very cool in both cases. I'm curious always, I don't know why I have this interest. I have a very strong interest in how people work. I don't know why, no matter what the work is, just, I really enjoy watching people work and learning about people's work. So maybe Kim, start with you. Why don't we start with acting? Cause you've done both. What is the work of acting involve, right?
Well, a lot of the work of acting is getting the work, to be honest, tracking down a play to be in, getting cast. It's you're always applying for the next job and looking for opportunities to work with people. It's a full-time gig to, like, every single day I'm on the Equity webpage looking at what every theater across the country is doing and who they need for those roles. And, you know, if it fits with the dates I've got available with my teaching schedule and, and so that's a big part of it. Then there's the exciting moment of you get an email or you get a phone call and you're either called back or just cast in something, and like printing the script or getting it sent to you. And I always start with, you know, looking up any words I don't know about in my lines or that anyone else says. So I at least know what's going on, and highlighting the text and memorizing. So I'll record it for myself and I'll write it out over and over and just read the lines over and over and over until I've got it all in my head. And I require actors to come in off book as well when there's time and from when they're cast to come back. So like we cast Gloria in the fall and they all came in February knowing their lines, which gave us a huge head start for being able to actually act. A lot of times at talkbacks, people will ask, how did you learn all those lines? And it's like, well, that's just the base level. You know, right. That's like, that's the canvas we're working on. That's knowing how to play the instruments. So,
right.
That's an awful lot of fun.
That's very interesting to me.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Then there's the character and text analysis.
And we have a little delay. Kim.
Okay.
Kim, you and I have a little delay, I think, here, but that's okay. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's, I guess, the perk of us being on separate tracks, isn't it? Because it can be moved together. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we'll figure it out. But go ahead. You have them coming off book. As you're saying, that's just like the canvas, right? That's just a base. And then what, you just go into rehearsal?
Pardon? Oh, no.
Kim,
I can hear you loud and clear, yeah.
Can you hear me, Kim? Yep.
Yes, I can.
Okay, good. I was just asking, so once you have that base, once you have the lines memorized, that's not the same thing as acting, obviously, right?
Oh, you're cutting out again. I'm so sorry. Maybe you should go to Matt.
Okay, we'll go to Matt. We'll come back to you.
Oh, now I can hear you, of
course. Kim, you can try logging off and back
okay,
in.
Okay, I'll do that.
Oh, now you can hear me? Oh, well, let's go back to you. No, that's okay. Stay on if you can hear me now.
Great.
If you can hear me now, that's fine. I just wonder what comes next. I mean, so you learned the lines and then what?
So you have a first read through at rehearsal and you just sit around a table with everybody. And they do this for television and film as well. The first read and you just get to hear the story aloud for the first time in the voices of the people who are going to be performing it. And that's a really beautiful thing. There's all sorts of text and character analysis. You can write down everything your character says about themselves and everything everybody else says about you and what you say about other people. And there are all these questions that I always ask about a character. Like I like to figure out their astrological sign and what their habits are, what they do, how they sleep, if they live alone, what they eat, how they dress. It's always interesting from a historical perspective, like what did they have for birth control and feminine hygiene? What were the options available to these women I'm playing? So I love researching the history of the character and the time period. And then you start collaborating with the director and the cast members and start roughing out those people from the stone, from the marble, and figuring out how to fit into the overall world of the play. And it depends based on the director you have. You know, it could be a totally conceptual performance of a piece, or it could be something that's like got all sorts of added layered, you know, music or movement or a different time period. All these twists can help enhance the experience, or like sometimes how you read the play and how you see it is exactly how the director sees it. And so you can start collaborating that way. So it's just an awful lot of fun. Then you rehearse, usually about 100 hours. And then there's a tech process, wow, which is when Matt and his folks come in and make all the magic happen. And everybody's like, oh my God, I look so cool in this costume. And wow, it feels real under lights. And oh my gosh, now that I'm wearing the shoes, it's like, you know, it becomes very real. And then trying to not lose any of that, any of the work you did in front of an audience, you know, letting that fluff an actor up, but not, being alive and present in the moment without having totally,
I guess, not trip them up,
probably. New wonky choices that are showing off for an audience.
This is all awesome to me because my brother, Matt, you'll appreciate this, especially Matt. My brother does, he's had a long career in lighting out in Hollywood, TV and film. And I never really appreciated the tech side. I used to have this idea. I was talking to our colleague Sean Cobb about this, that, you know, it's just the director. Sorry, Kim, the director who does it all, you know. But oh my God, it's such a collaborative effort. And you, Kim, you just mentioned, you know, costumes. I mean, the people designing the costumes. But I like that. That really helps me, actually, because I've always wondered, how do actors learn their lines? And I mean, I'm sure there's no one way. You mentioned your method, but learning the lines is just one step along many for the actor, as you're suggesting, Kim. Matt, what about you? How do you approach? I mean, let's say you're designing a scene or working on lighting, sound. How do you start? What do you do?
Well, that's a good springboard, Greg, because what a director brings to the rehearsal process is an entire world, an entire atmosphere, an environment that's all locked in their head. So when we start with, like, Gloria, for example, our first production meeting consists of Kim telling us about everything that's been going through her head since she was charged with directing the show. And that can be big, broad concepts about the themes of the play, down to the little minutiae, like she was saying, the astrological sign of the lead character, because that is all fuel for our fire. And then we will take that information away. We'll go ruminate on that for a week or maybe 2 weeks, and then come back in another production meeting. And each of the designers in their own area will produce either sketches or generate like a Pinterest board of images that are all related to their design concept based on the director's concept. Wow. And all of those ideas, then we kind of talk about and collaborate about. And some of the ideas that one designer picks up or presents will kind of ping back and forth between other people in the production team. And we'll develop some really great ideas or threads to latch on to as far as design concept goes. Sometimes that sparks or awakens new things in the director. And then the director will come back and say, ooh, I didn't think about this. Let's talk about that. And so in the first 2 to 4 weeks of design process, it's a lot of volleying back and forth about what we could do and what we are capable of doing. and what we really want to do in order to support the story, because in the end, everything we do has to support the story and the characters and the plot and everything that we are trying to reproduce for the audience as the playwright intended. So it's a lot of planning. We front load a lot of the work in order to make a cohesive design for the audience at the end.
That again is really cool and interesting to me, because what you're describing is anything but a static process. I mean, there's planning, but then there's all this interplay. It's a very dynamic process as you describe it, which again, I hadn't really thought about. Do you also, I assume you read the play, I mean, but do you also do some extra research, Matt, into the time period, or do you just sort of rely more on what the director has in her head?
Yeah, once I've figured out how to sound out the big words and get through the scripty part, there's a lot of research that happens. If it's a period piece, if it's something that's happened outside our lifetime, or at least the last 30, 40 years, we all do a ton of research to find out what is both appropriate to include in the show, but also to find those interesting things about the people or the place or the time or the political environment or the you name it, that we can draw those design concepts on. And the fun thing is when 5 or 6 or 8 or however many people you have on your production team, when you all do your own individual research on the same thing at the same time, you come back with very different answers.
Oh yeah, sure.
And it's really interesting to see what people pick up on and what's most important to them, or at least most interesting to them in that process. And it can create some very interesting revelations. You're undergoing a little bit of personal archaeology and sociology and anthropology when you look back at a period piece, and then drawing those correlations to things that are going on today, whether it's something about society or about personal development or politics or whatever. So even as professors, we are diving into the research and learning more about our world every time we do a show.
Yeah, you mentioned, those disciplines, anthropology and sociology, surely. And also, really, what you're describing is historical research. And you described it very well. I mean, you put 3 or 4 different historians in the same room. We've researched the same topic or the same era. Our answers are not going to be the same. And somehow the history, as close as we can get to the past, assuming there was a past, that's another question for another time. But, it comes out of that debate and discussion. So again, it's a collaborative process, even in the research. Maybe you're doing the research individually, but once you come together and bring your research into the room, your findings into the room, it's collaborative. Kim, and Matt, what you just said leads me to back to you, Kim. A couple of questions. Not sure they're related. One, I'm just curious about the differences between directing and acting, and whether you think a good director should also have been or be an actor. And then the other question, this relates to what Matt just said about connecting to the present world. Somewhere you wrote something about how theater can help us challenge and subvert the status quo. I think that's almost a direct quote. I wonder about both of those questions, your thoughts about that. I mean, so the first question is really 2 questions, I guess. What are the differences between and similarities between directing and acting, and should a director have been or be an actor? Why don't we take those questions first?
I think there are huge differences between being an actor and a director, just in the scope of how you approach the project and how you understand the work. An actor still needs to understand what instrument they're playing in that orchestra, or how they contribute to the greater pieces as a whole. It can't just be bullshit, 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 my line. But a director is not reading a play and thinking like, which character would I want to say the lines? Who do I want to advocate for? Who do I believe in and feel most compelled to? They have to, there are champions within the script and people that they're going to identify with, but it's thinking about the entire world of the play that they're creating with the designers, as Matt was saying. So it's the whole, the idea, the philosophy of the show. Whereas an actor shows up for rehearsal and it's sort of like, what do you want me to do? I'm ready. I'm ready to play. I'm nimble. I'm warmed up. You know, let's bounce ideas back and forth. Let's create some things. But they're worried very much about their one role that they're playing. And a director is volleying between several different designers and a technical director and the cast and a stage management team and sort of keeping all these balls in the air and lots of different windows that they're peeking into and like helping coordinate between. And almost all the directors I've worked with were an actor at some point. I think that's a natural career progression. Though I think designers read a script, in my mind, more closely in many ways to a director than an actor would for that initial, like when they're reading plays, what they're looking for that world of the play that it's in and the mise-en-scene and the, like what the audience is going to feel from the outside and how they're going to experience it. Whereas I think an actor can very easily get caught up in the minutia. So I would be totally open to working with someone who is a designer turned director. I think that would be brilliant. I do think having experience in the theater is important before becoming a director, just because, like I said, you're coordinating with so many different components of the production, and having a respect for what everybody's job is super important.
Right. That makes sense to me. I wonder, as you're speaking, another question occurred to me, and then we'll come to the question about the present connections to the present day, challenging the status quo. But I wonder, as a director, how concerned are you with what the playwright intended, if that's even possible to determine? Or is that not, I mean, are you simply working with the text of the play, whatever is there? You're not reading things about the playwright or what the playwright has said about the play or reviews of other productions? I don't know.
I think that's part of what's so important about understanding the historical context of the script, both the time when it was written and the time that it's set in, because it's going to give you a sense of why they were talking about what they're talking about, why that mattered at the time. And then, of course, there are universal themes throughout history that it's going to parallel to today. But there, and I have friends I've had heated debates with about whether it matters what the playwright wanted. In a sense, I kind of think the playwright's God. They created the whole world that we're living in and talking about. And having something as an artist that you're in reference to is very important, rather than thinking that you are generating the content. I just saw, oh man, who's the guy who started the plein air painting movement, and Rodin has a sculpture of him, and it's the...
Oh gosh, yes.
Anyway,
yeah,
a French painter.
Yeah, I know who you mean. I'm sorry.
Who painted outside.
Yes.
And Rodin's sculpture of him is
well, not
something about...
Yeah, anyway, it doesn't matter.
No, it's not. We'll find it later.
It's okay.
He sculpts him as the observer, and it's so beautiful to see him in reference to what he is looking at and what he's trying to understand. And so I think the playwright is another person that if you can have in the room, that's amazing. Or if you can be trying to pick through, like, what did they mean by that? Why did they write that? Because that's what stood the test of time to an extent, is the play, the words on the page. And while we can cut them and we can layer on additional artistic choices or, you know, time periods, ultimately we are creating something in reference to their original work.
That is all. Again, maybe I should have gone into the theater. I don't know.
It's
somehow
not too late,
I find it extremely interesting. that's what some people. I think teaching is acting in some ways, performing anyway. I find it very interesting. Gosh, and another question just occurred to me, but I'll save that one for later, I think. Yeah, I mean, first of all, the play, any play was written at a certain point in time, but like the past, it's not dead, right? As you're suggesting, yeah. I mean, it's still speaking to us in our present. And I guess that leads me to that other question. Picking up, I did find the quote you said. This is in a Q&A with you after you were hired in your present position. You're talking about the students. We will decide together how we proceed as an art form. And this has far-reaching effects on global politics as we challenge and subvert the status quo. I know we all say things in Q&A sometimes, so we don't remember. But thoughts about that? I don't want to put you on the spot too much. But, I mean, I find that very interesting. Is that something you're thinking about with every play or just sort of in general as a teacher, director?
Yeah, that's something that was really instilled in me at Gustavus. And I think that is a quote probably from Amy Seaham, that everything is political. And you're either subverting or supporting the status quo with everything you do every day. And I remember being a fiery young student at Gustavus and, you know, people sometimes being like, stop making things so political, or just after college, you know, like you're so political, but everything we do, how we dress, how we walk, how we perform our identity in the world and how we interact with other people, how we think and talk to other people, it's all political. Whether or not you're falling in line and doing what is expected of you, or somehow pushing up against the system and performing that identity or communicating ideas that somehow flip the script on that or get people to question it. So I very much believe that. And art's a really important tool to do that with. I think the best works of art make you think differently about the world. We all kind of get going through life on autopilot, and it's really easy to be like, next I go to fourth grade and then fifth grade. And these are the things I have to check off in life. I get married and then I buy a house and thinking about like, what else is life expansively? What is the meaning of it? What's our existential purpose? And am I missing or overlooking something that is equally of value, while I'm going through what is expected of me?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I'm all about, and by the way, I like to say, I'm not the only one who says that, you know, history, being a historian is being an artist. I mean, history isn't a science, it's an art. But I couldn't agree more about the role of art, the importance of art in helping us to see ourselves differently, and the world differently. You know, it's also okay just simply to enjoy art, right?
Yeah.
You know, obviously, you want people to enjoy. Yeah. Matt, I'm actually in both of your cases. I'm curious. Are there before we get to the spring play? Are there particular genres you like working in, doing your design and tech work? I mean, music. It seems like you've done a fair amount of musical theater.
I do enjoy musical theater, and I have a fairly thorough music background, band and choir and show choir and those things growing up. So musical theater was just has always been a real nice fit. They always tell you, if you can read music, put that in your resume, because so many people it can't. But it's really all of it. There's a certain magic to theater in every genre. And honestly, my genre in theater is teaching other people how to make theater. And I think that's kind of true for most of us in academia, because we spread out over so many genres and try to expose the students to lots of different types of theater and ways of producing it. I always wanted to be a teacher, and I had to relegate myself for a while to not teaching for a number of reasons in life when you make mistakes in your early 20s. And found my way back to it and really enjoy the process, because the artists that we are working with are learning how to develop that art and how to push the envelope. And again, either support or disrupt the status quo. So one of our slogans or a big motto in the department is we create creators. Hmm. And that's really why I enjoy doing what I do, because there's nothing more impressive than seeing the students go out into the world and make their own art and know that you had a small hand in that. You and your team had a hand in creating that particular creator, and it feels good.
Yeah, that's got to be so gratifying. There's the version of that for all of us who teach at whatever level. I'm going to take the liberty, Matt, of reading from your teaching philosophy statement, because I like it, one, and two, it relates to what you just said. And so, Matt, you wrote or you write in your teaching philosophy statement on your webpage, no two students learn alike, and no two designers create alike. It is that diversity and challenge that inspires me to foster an environment that meets the needs of each artist on his or her journey to master our craft. And that's, I think, so well said. And that applies, as far as I'm concerned, that applies to no matter what discipline. I mean, I could use that as a professor of history. So well said, and kind of saying what you already just said. And I think, we might forget that, when we come to a play at Gustavus, that both of you are teachers. You're not just, working on that particular play. You're trying to teach the students involved, not just in that play, but other students too, the craft, or the crafts, I should say, plural. Kim, what about you? Are there particular genres you like? And here I'd like you to talk a little bit about the Solstan play you did in the fall. But are there certain genres you really enjoy working in?
I was trained in Suzuki by professors who studied with Tadashi Suzuki in the 80s in Japan. And so I'm very firmly rooted in this idea of not cranking emotionally as a performer, but letting the work come out of you, being physically in alignment, and being, I sort of referenced this earlier, just being nimble and ready to play and warmed up vocally and open to that collaboration. And so I think that can lend itself to all sorts of different genres. I did more musicals growing up. That's sort of what got me into theater. And I'll be directing next January. I get to direct the January term musical Spring Awakening. But I also really enjoy straight theater and performing and directing in that. And I think that the movement of the body and the alignment and the voice is just as important. And in many ways, if you're reading it intensely, it can be just as musical as actual music. So Solstan is, it was in line with Suzuki in that it's also a Japanese art form. Shogo Ota pioneered that form of theater, and it's completely silent and people move in a very slow, almost meditative state. And that's something I trained in partnership with the Suzuki training in my graduate studies. And I just think it's so valuable as a performer to be able to slow down and think about one thing at a time, this then that is what the saying is, focusing on, one thing at a time. We don't know the outcome of the play. We can't telegraph why we're saying this so that the next thing can come out, but just hearing and responding to what is right in front of you, which is what we do in real life. So I really enjoy that.
That anticipates a question about Solstan, which is, or that kind of, is I think what you call maybe slow tempo theater or devise, but is there really no plot? And I wonder how, if there is no plot, how did the audience respond?
There is a plot, though, Hamlet's father doesn't start murdered necessarily. So typically there's some sort of catastrophe that has happened and people are traveling from one place to another for some reason that you may not know because there's not language to support that or text to support that narrative. So it does, like dance, allow for more of the audience assigning meaning. But again, to quote another teacher of mine again, Robin Hunt would always say, everything communicates. So anything that's happening on stage, people in the audience will assign meaning to. And the more specific that an actor is, whether that's through spoken word or through movement, the more concise and specific they can be, the more universal that's going to seem to the audience as they're able to apply that to their lives, in my opinion.
Okay. Thank you. What about, let's turn to Gloria now in the time remaining, the spring play, which opens Thursday, May 5th. So everyone go online, get tickets. This podcast conversation should drop about a week before. First, how do you, and maybe Kim, you can start, and Matt, if you want to chime in also, how do you, tell us just briefly, what's the process of choosing a play, whether it's in the fall or the spring or J term, doesn't matter. How do you do it?
Yeah. Matt, do you want to take that?
it's a unique formula when you're working in academia. Mm-hmm. Because you have the interests and the capabilities of the production team that you usually do, but then you also have a demographic limitation in casting or supporting the show production-wise because of the number of students that you have in a particular program. So for us, it is a bit of a challenge being a small private liberal arts school in southern Minnesota, because you don't always have the robust numbers or necessarily the diversity quotient that you would like to explore in modern pieces. But we look at a lot of different scripts with a lot of optimism, and we've been very fortunate because we do have access to a very intentional and thoughtful group of students that want to participate in the theater and dance as in an earnest capacity. They're not just doing it just because it's fun in their free time type of thing and don't give it a lot of effort. Our students are very committed, and we've been very lucky in both number and diversity to be able to do shows like Last Days of Judas Iscariot that we just did for our J-term show, and Gloria coming up. So we have to kind of throw all of those variables into the hopper, and then the directors will propose titles that are of interest, and that could range on, we haven't done Shakespeare in a few years. We should throw a Shakespeare in here so that we've got that experience. And then looking at the capabilities of the physical theater and the program and what kind of shows we can support in our spaces in the amount of production time we have. So that very complicated algorithm that would make a calculus professor cry would get sorted out over the course of several weeks of department meetings. And then hopefully if we've got it all together, we can make a new season announcement in March for the following year.
Okay. Again, extremely interesting to me. Kim, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. That in a professional theater, often an artistic director will be the one, or a committee supporting the artistic director will pick a season, and they may even cast a show for you. So you're coming in with, like, this is your cast and this is the show you're doing. They've hired you in to do. Whereas here we have the privilege of picking projects that we're passionate about, of course, with the caveat that they need to support the student growth and make sense for the students that we have in the department. It helps that students are allowed to participate in Gustavus Theater even if they're not a major. So that allows us to cast a wider net and bring in people for that liberal arts experience that otherwise may not have become involved. And when I look for a play that I want to do, I like something that's going to make you laugh and laugh and laugh and then think.
Yeah. So Gloria obviously will do that. Tell us a little bit about maybe Kim, you can start. I'm sure it will. Without, without giving too much away, to the extent that you can, tell us a little bit about the play.
It's a beautiful
production. Kim, you can start.
Yeah, we are setting it in 2011 to 2013, so it's already funny to be working with the students on, like, we didn't have that then. that didn't exist. And, you know, we didn't have, I can't even think of what now. What's an example of one? Like, Twitter was just becoming a thing.
Like, we're trying to pick out technology.
Right. I mean, technology moves so quickly. God knows what wasn't available then.
Right. It's set in a city, but I think it fits for this age group, for the ambitions of people who are starting out in their careers and wanting to climb, and the frustrations of seeing people pass them by, or maybe getting can you hear me still?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, okay, great. I think it's great for looking at people's ambitions, and then seeing either people pass them by or seeing someone who has been in the same dead-end position and feeling those early career questions that I think Gustavus students are starting to anticipate, as they're like, what am I going to do after this in May? I don't have a job yet. And so looking at that, there's whip smart dialogue back and forth between the actors, and it really doesn't pull punches in terms of insults toward one another. We've updated some of the gender language and pronouns, which is pretty typical when there's gender-blind casting. But I don't know. I haven't seen plays with non-binary characters that weren't specifically written about non-binary characters or trans characters, you know, and that's what the play's about. So it's sort of nice to give visibility to that, even though it's just a play about ambition and trauma and what we are, how we spin narrative. The play is super funny, and then it also has some really poignant, thoughtful moments that the students are delving into and finding some great thoughtful moments too. And of course, a little bit of light buys you a lot of dark. So having all of that laughter creates the space for serious conversation.
When was the play written, and is there a date in which it's supposed to be? So you said you're setting it in 2011, 2013.
It was written in 2016, or it first performed, and that's when it was nominated for the Pulitzer. And it's based on our detective work. It had to have been like late aughts or early teens, based on the references that they make in the script.
Okay. And Matt, in approaching this play, well, how are you approaching it? Are you trying to? You're building. It sounds like you're. Correct me if I'm wrong. But you're building the sets. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, we build. So Lydia Francis, who is another Gustavus alum, is working as our interim scenic designer, and it's her job to catch that aesthetic visually. So we feel the 2010s as we hear the characters in 2010. Mm. So there's a lot of us talking back and forth about this detail would look more appropriate, or this detail would be ideal for this situation. And without giving a ton away, there's two different office settings, and one is very much New York East Coast drab, for lack of a better word. And then the other one is LA office, a little brighter feeling, more colorful, maybe a little more casual. And so we have to look at all of those adjectives and figure out what that means visually. And then I break that down into how we build, what we build, and how fast we build it in order to get it on stage in time for the show.
Man, so, it sounds complicated to me. Challenging, rewarding for sure once you're, I suppose, in the process and done, but complicated. I mean, so right, there's what you're making me understand, it's sort of obvious, I guess, but there's not just the translation that the actors have to do in the and the director too, but the translation that has to go on around the tech and scenic design stuff. So correct. In your case, you know, I mean, the designer, did you say her name is Lydia or
Lydia?
Lydia has to, I mean, she has to translate, then you have to translate her translate. I mean, it's amazing.
Matt really has the hardest part of the job too, because, you know, I just am like, here are ideas. Here are things I see in my head. And then Lydia is able to actually draw that out, both digitally and with pen and paper. And she's like, oh, what you're saying is this. This is what that would look like. And then Matt actually makes that like physical 3D creation of like, I want it to feel like this.
It's so cool. That's definitely Matt, what you do. It's definitely for me a big part of the magic. I mean, when I'm at a play and the curtain opens, right? You know, the play begins and you see the set, you know, you're kind of wondering. It's just, you know, sometimes you hear the audience like, you know, sucking their breath, right? It's just breathtaking. I'm already hooked just because of I love New York and LA where my brother lives, and I'm not sure I want to live in LA. Sorry, Larry, but do like visiting, and I'm interested in that kind of setting. It's also occurring to me as you're speaking, Matt, about the different office settings. I don't know what would it, I mean, I guess they may have had something like WeWork or whatever it's called back then, but these sound like more traditional office settings, like where you'd go to work in an office, not a shared big workspace like we might have today. Where are you both at as we're winding down here? Where are you at in the process? I mean, I know the play is what, about 2 months away. As we're recording, it'll be closer in time when this episode drops. But are you well into rehearsals now? Are the scene, are the sets built? Matt, you want to start?
We are, because it's a contemporary show and the furniture and set decorating elements are all very modern. We actually started kind of backwards. Normally we would build base structure for a set. You know, if it was a show that took place in someone's living room, a la Neil Simon, we would be building walls and floors and things right now and getting the skeleton up. And then we would be decorating it later with furniture and props and that sort of thing. But because of the contemporary setting, we actually started by obtaining as much of the office stuff as we could first so that the actors could use it in rehearsal and get a feel for the lay of the land and the physical obstacles that are around them. So we're into it. We're a couple weeks into it, but we haven't actually built any of the skeleton. What we've done is picked up desks, computer monitors, printers, chairs that roll, all of the ephemera that sits on top of your desk, your inboxes and pencil organizers and stuff. So we've been picking up those things, so that they're available in rehearsal. And then in about another week and a half or so, 2 weeks, we get to load into the actual theater because right now the dance floor is in.
All right, for the dance concert.
For the spring dance concert.
Right.
So we don't have physical access to the space. So over the next 2 weeks, my crew will work on assembling things, putting wall units together, finding doors, that sort of thing, and kind of prepare all of that in the shop with the space we have available. And then the whistle blows and we all go charging into the theater. And in 2 weeks' time, we'll have the entire thing put up.
It's amazing. And Kim, I heard you laughing when I asked the question, where are you at in this process? So go ahead. Where are you at in this process?
No, we're well into rehearsals. Like I said, the students came in off book, so staging it was pretty smooth. It was specifically that we have a dance concert next week in the department. So just laughing about like from a we know what the designs are and we have a lot of pieces in place and a plan for that, I know. But just knowing that that might have been a triggering question for Matt.
Oh, got it. Yeah. And I, yeah, the dance concert coming up. The dance concert will have occurred by the time this drops. Oh, so yeah. I mean, that's a whole another awesome part of the department. And I did podcast with Michelle Rosinko.
Okay.
Yeah. By the time this drops, I hope people have seen, I had a wonderful conversation with Michelle Rosinko, the chair of the department and dancer herself, and very much involved with that concert. I know you both have to go, but a quick final question, thoughts from you each, and maybe Matt, start with you. I'll give Kim the last word since she's the gusty here. But what is it about theater and the liberal arts that you think is important? I mean, why should anyone care about theater in the context of a liberal arts college? Matt, you take it away, however you want.
A very wise career counselor from another institution who I never actually met told a student of mine once that you'll get hired for your technical skill, your ability to work in whatever discipline you're in, and then which is great, but you'll get fired for your lack of soft skills. Oh, that's and awesome. And the thing is, if none of my students go off to make theater, that doesn't bother me. What I know is going to happen is that they are going to go out into the world, and they have had, for some of them, up to 4 years of experience if they've been with us since their first year. And they've had practical application for time management, communication, teamwork, problem solving, all of those things that make a good employee, but also a great artist or just a great person in general.
Right.
They're going to be an entrepreneur or do something else in the greater world. And when the California school system a number of years ago was asked the Fortune 500 companies, what do you look for most in a graduate now from an undergraduate program? And they say, well, we don't really care about what degree. We're looking for someone who can communicate, problem solve, be a team player, da 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 da. And with his, all the respect to all of the other disciplines that we have in our liberal arts school, there aren't a lot of disciplines that do that. Our high impact practice of creating theater while we teach theater means that those students have that much more experience honing those soft skills. So that's
right.
That's paramount to me.
And really, maybe except for the actors, I'm kind of kidding here, but you know, learning how to collaborate and work as a team, which I know employers value too. And that's so true about, I mean, gosh, if only we could get our students to understand that, and maybe their parents, but you know, it does not matter what your discipline is, what your major is. It does not matter. It may matter to you, but in terms of, you know, what you wind up doing in life, Kim, go ahead, take it away. You get the last word as the Gustavus alum.
Well, I will say actors are definitely collaborating up there too. They are, they need each other, and they need the designers, and they need the technicians and stage managers in order to do the work they do. So I think there's definitely a sense of that. And because it is a liberal arts school, students on the acting or directing track also, within the honors at least, have to stage manage. And so they have an appreciation for that as well. I think I'll echo what Matt said about time management. And you know, that's exactly what we were saying with how do you memorize all those lines? Well, you just do it. That's like, how did you read all those history books, Greg? How did you learn so much? Like, well, you just took the time and you did it. That's, that wasn't like, so I think being able to creative problem solve is extremely important too. And then the history, like we were talking about, all yes. the research, if they do end up pursuing theater professionally, having a liberal arts education gives them a totally different experience than some of the, BFA programs that I guess teach for, where they are so focused on the technical aspects of the work that they're doing. At Gustavus and at other liberal arts institutions, they're focused on being lifelong learners, which is what theater does. It gives you the chance to say, okay, this next project, I'm in the 1920s and I'm going to play this type of character and in this situation, and figuring out how to research that and whether that's to perform in it or design in it, it's such a fascinating process. And so I think both theater supports the other programs and departments, and then having that liberal arts base supports our students. So it's to me, and you know, I'm a little biased, but it's the perfect major for a liberal arts degree. And I totally agree with you guys. a wise man once told me, it doesn't matter what you major in, you're at a liberal arts school. So it should. I had friends who at Gustavus were told, like, you can't major in theater, major in religion. And I thought, well, what are you going to do with a BA in religion? What are you going to do with a, you know, Greg, but a BA in history? I mean, all of those require more education if you're going to work in that field. So why not study what you love? And if you're pursuing what you're passionate about, that's going to give you the best results in life, because you're going to want to dig in creatively and learn the most that you can.
That's the key. Pursue. I mean, I wish. Yes, that is the key. Pursue what you are passionate about, at least at that moment. And in pursuing that, you may discover you're not that passionate about it. Right. And you'll be passionate about something else. But yeah, maybe learning how to be passionate about something is what's most important. Anyway, this has been a real treat for me, because I do love the theater so much. I have vivid memories of going to the theater as a kid with my parents in Chicago. I think it was maybe Barefoot in the Park we first saw us, and then going to the theater at Northern Illinois University in DeKalb when I was there for my BA and MA. And I still love going to the theater here in the Twin Cities and in New York when I can. You're talking to someone who's seen Hamilton 3 times, but never with Lin-Manuel. So one day, maybe. Anyway, thank you both. All the best on the production. Can't wait to see it. It starts Thursday, May 5th, listeners, and I think runs through Sunday, right? Is that right?
Correct.
Yeah. So get tickets, show up, and it sounds like we will be incredibly stimulated. So thank you both. Try to get some rest, too, between now and then, and take good care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
You're welcome. Learning for Life at Gustavus is produced by J.J. Aiken and Matthew Dobosensky of the Gustavus Office of Marketing, Gustavus graduate Will Clark, class of 20, who also provides technical expertise to the podcast, and me. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gustavus Adolphus College.